Yo fam, we got a surprise for you. And by we, I mean my special guest. We're trapped in a car for 2.5 more hours of a 6-hour drive. And I have nobody else to talk to but you and
me. Hello, hello. Sarah Moore reporting for duty.
For those of y'all that don't know, that is my wonderful wife. And I find myself loving her much more when I'm thinking about how great we are, how great she is, and how great we get along. And it's usually when we're not together. Imagine that. Because when we are together, I have a tendency to point the finger, make sure I'm on guard, make sure she doesn't tell me what to do. That's actually not fully true. I do enjoy our time together. We had a good time this weekend. We went down to Nashville 10 to a conference. Sarah did a pump up session and she killed it. But I had a number of conversations with people, and it reminded me of a topic that I don't think I talk about enough, which is the hours necessary to spend on your mental, emotional, and spiritual wellness. You've heard me talk about, you know, 10, 15, sometimes 20 hours a week with prayer, meditation, journaling, counseling, coaching, support groups, mentorship calls, you know, all the things. Something, the hours, in my opinion, should match what a physical wellness plan, a physical workout plan. And I was talking to people. These are a lot of people that are into personal development. A lot of them are religious folk. And a lot of the speakers even mentioned, you know, going to that building on Sundays and reading that devotional, the 2-minute one, the 2-minute read, because you know you can blaze through it and, you know, send a shout out prayer and keep it moving is not enough if you want to have the ability to emotionally regulate and feel the whole and the soul. And anyway, I just wanted to talk about that as a topic, and maybe Sarah and I will talk a little bit about what we've been doing lately with the hours that we're putting in. And I'm hoping Sarah will talk about the epiphany she's had around her mental, emotional, and spiritual, the amount of hours she puts in, and maybe she'll share that with you. What do you think about that topic, babe?
It's a great topic. From stage, one of the speakers said that 2-minute devotional is, what, in my words, the dessert. And where's the main course, right? The 2-minute devotional, the 2-minute reading, the 5-minute podcast, the 5-minute breathwork session, that's in addition to. And I couldn't agree more. I personally often say, and I just wrote this in my book, I need 3 hours in the morning. That's my ideal length of time between waking up and doing any work in or on my business to get my mind, body, and soul right. And even when I write that and or I tell people, I shy away from it a little. It sounds like such a privilege as a business owner, as a mother, as a person in this world to want or need 3 hours a day. I really do though. By the time I wake up, by the time I go to the loo, by the time I go downstairs and get some water, by the time I do a workout and have a shower and get dressed, that can be an hour and 15 minutes by itself. And I haven't journaled, meditated, had a nice breakfast, took a few quiet moments to think. And actually leaving the conference, one of the thoughts that I've been having is, how could I reorganize my schedule to allow more space in the morning? And I already do a pretty good job and I have a decent amount of time. And I'm thinking, maybe it needs to be a bit more sacred. Maybe it needs to be a bit more intentional. I don't know the answer to that yet, and I don't need to know. It's just a thought that I'm having.
One of the things that made me think about this topic was we've been driving for, 4 hours or so, and we like to listen to recovery talks. Right now, we're in this family recovery. So for family recovery, family support groups, that's like Al-Anon, ACA, codependence talks is a big one. We just listened to a podcast with Glennon Doyle and her partner, Abby Wambach. They interviewed Melody Beatty, and she is one of the most famous personal development writers, particularly around codependence and detachment. They actually use a lot of her literature in Al-Anon around codependence. Codependent No More was her big book, which I actually just read recently. And just thinking of going back to this idea of hours, like so many people ask, when I tell someone you need to spend 10 to 15 hours a week on your mental, emotional, and spiritual wellness, that's not just taking time to put your feet in the foot rubber so you have, you're getting a foot massage or painting your nails or doing self-care. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about, listening to recovery talks on podcasts, reading positive literature, if it's devotional, if it's some sort of spiritual or religious, or if it's a Just for Today or some other daily reader, Codependent No More, talking to people, accountability partners in your circle that you can. I just had a call from a buddy today, that's saying, hey, I've had all this good stuff happen, but I still feel funky. And we're talking through this, so we talk for an hour. We kind of catch up on stuff, but we're talking about the I call it recovery, but it's the emotional state that doesn't include counseling or coaching or therapy. That, so many people, when they're relying on just counseling, coaching, and therapy, I feel funky now, but I don't have a therapy session for 2 weeks. So what do you do in the meantime to kind of work through that? But I just, I'll say this, and I'm going to ask Sarah something, but I keep talking to people that really haven't gone into that 10 to 15 hours a week, especially around recovery stuff or things that are outside of a religious building or a counseling or therapy couch. But it's, well, how in the heck am I going to get 10 or 15 hours in when I have kids, I've got a family, I've got a job? And I go, well, why don't there's talks online about the exact topics in which they're sharing with me, around whether it's some compulsive behavior, whether it's addiction or just compulsion, compulsive behaviors that don't involve drugs or alcohol, or someone in their family is having some challenges, or codependence, or their need to manage and control everything. Maybe they've got some anxiety, depression, or other, emotional illnesses going on. That if we are going to change a behavior long term, we've got to do more than an hour a week. But one thing I was thinking about for Sarah was, what's changed in your program recently where you started going to more meetings or listening to more recovery literature? Maybe you can share some of that journey with the peeps, kind of from the family or the other half side of that.
Sure. I have been in a season professionally where I'm getting everything I want. And I have felt on the inside that I am just trying to cling on for dear life and hold on for the ride, because it's felt hard. Getting everything I want. And that doesn't mean everything, just a lot of really good opportunities and seeing lots of great growth and, things I've dreamed of in my business. Doesn't mean all perfect, just a season of up-leveling. And guess what? I have to up-level along with those opportunities to be ready to meet them. So I've been humbled because part of me thinks, oh great, I'm getting everything I want. This is gonna be so easy. Look at me, how fun. And I found myself feeling exactly the opposite. And then feeling, as Preston said to his buddy earlier, somewhat confused. Because aren't I supposed to feel excited and grateful and like life is fantastic because I'm getting everything I want? So, you know, what's the disconnect? And so I've been struggling through that. I'm doing all the things I usually do, breath work, journaling, you know, even, you know, we teach what we need to learn. So even when I'm on a coaching session with a client, there's always some nugget that comes up that I say, oh God, okay, I'm listening. I needed to hear that too. You know, attending my Al-Anon meeting regularly, talking with my sponsor, and still feeling the struggle. So I was sharing with Preston one day in tears how challenging it's felt. And I have a history with depression and suicidal thinking, and I've really been feeling as though depression is just right there, you know, that I could choose to grab onto it and woof, it would get even tougher. And he said, I'll say this once and then I'll leave it alone. Didn't you say maybe going to more meetings?
That's so when I was joking earlier about loving and getting along better with Sarah when we're not together, because
it's funny, it's not the greatest thing to hear, go ahead.
Sarah gets salty when I joke about that, however,
for good reason, I believe.
But when I, like, I don't like Sarah telling me what to do, even when she's right. I don't want her to give me suggestions. I don't want her coaching me. It is, in my words, she's too close, it's too triggering, and I usually can't handle it because it's, you know, that's why outside, you know, men that I talk to or support, you know, accountability partners or sponsorship or mentorship is so good for me because I can hear it from them because we don't live together. We're not, you know, we're not so close. But anyway, so when I make suggestions for Sarah, I tread lightly because I know how I feel, and I also don't want it to come across as a criticism or whatever. So I did say, I'm only going to say this once and take it and do with it what you will, but I feel like it's important to say. And so what do you remember what I said versus what I think I said?
Hey, you did great. You said, I'll say this once and then I'll leave it alone, which is maybe it could be a good idea to go to more meetings. And, you know, Preston's example right here is a good example of love languages. It's not our job to love somebody in the way that we want to be loved. It's our job to love them in the way they want to be loved. And so it's this interesting dynamic for Preston of treading lightly when he offers suggestions, where I actually often will say, share your suggestions with me. I want them. I respect you. I want to hear them. I might not always take them well in the moment. I'm not supposed to. And please give them to me. I want to hear what you have to say. And he's treading lightly because it's challenging for him, right? So I'm sure I can relate in other areas. And so I listened and I said, you're right. Every fiber of my being belongs in Al-Anon. I know that without a shadow of a doubt. And yet I'll find myself in various seasons where I fight going to meetings, or I fight doing my step work, or whatever that might be. And so I've started listening to Al-Anon speaker tapes, you can simply go to YouTube and Google speakers. And I can do that any moment, any time, and I can be immersed in the struggles that we in the rooms of Al-Anon bond over, right? And so I feel like I'm at home and I'm reminded of the hope and the message and that lies inside of the 12 steps. I have really started leaning into my sponsor more and picking up the phone, even when it's something tiny. I've always done a pretty good job of picking up the phone, and I'm given myself the grace to do it a lot more, because every time I get off the phone with my sponsor, every time, I feel a lot better. I feel more peaceful. I feel like I'm less alone. I feel like I have some version of a solution, even if I'm not sure what to do next. And, you know, it's working. Preston says I'm less in his shit. So, you know, I think that that's a real win for everyone.
100% a win. And I think it's, I remember the conversation around, it was emotional. Sarah was having an emotional time, and I have a tendency to go like, you know, what's the problem? Everything's going well. Or, you know, you know, even just to experience the struggle in relationship, even if when it's doesn't necessarily pertain to me, but I was just thinking of how grateful that it is for people that have a support structure, like a support, I call it peer-led support groups, like Al-Anon and AA and NA and CA and, you know, Celebrate Recovery, these type of support groups that you can access 24/7, because so few people, it's not that they don't have loving families, it's not that they don't have friends that'll listen to them, but I'm talking about people that the only thing you have in common is this foundation, this support, this personal development, this recovery process built on spiritual principles that we can use as a guide to figure out, is my thinking and is my feelings, do my thoughts and my feelings match the situation? Because that is why I'm such a big proponent of, especially when we're having a hard time, is doing like an abundance of, almost like too many speaker tapes, too many meetings, too much meditating, right? Like the average person goes, why are you doing it so much? Why do you need 3 hours in the morning? Why are you meditating for a full hour? Why are you going to multiple meetings a week? Well, if my problem is my thinking and my feelings, and I'm having issues professionally in my relationship, or even just with like what Sarah said, depression or anxiety, whatever, going to one support group a week and talking to one of your mentors, you know, once or twice a week, and going and see a counselor every other week, that shit ain't enough. I got to do things multiple times a day. I think that's why early in recovery, they'll tell people, you know, do the five things. You know, you read, you pray, you read literature, you pray, you meditate, you call someone on the phone, you go to a meeting. If it worked, then, you know, thank your higher power at night and do it again. Because when I wake up, rarely am I just raring to go, happy about life, you know, floating on a spiritual cloud of zen, right? Usually it's like my thoughts and feelings are kind of clunky. And so when I start my day off with that spiritual routine, which for me is about 2 to 3 hours as well, and then I'm checking in throughout the day and I'm doing all these things, and when I'm feeling skunky and funky, I'll listen to 2 or 3 hours worth of I like 12-step meetings, but 2 or 3 hours worth of material that talks about my thoughts, feelings, attitudes, and behaviors. It talks about it taking responsibility. It talks about, you know, self-will, me trying to ram and wrestle joy and satisfaction out of life, or the ability to be grateful and to be able to be grateful in the moment. Because even knowing that in my mind intellectually isn't enough. I've got to hear it over and over and over again. And I wish more people, particularly on the family side, the support side, the families of side, would do that more, because I feel like the addict and alcoholic kind of have the easy thing. At least they have at least they know what the thing is that they're looking at or trying to fix. So, Sarah, how has it been since you have upgraded and stepped up? What kind of feels a bit like abnormal for you, because you've always been a consistent one meeting a week, you know, having your service position, you know, talking to your sponsor on occasion, but how did that change, as opposed to you going, oh, well, now maybe I should get back into counseling, or maybe I need to see my breathwork therapist. We're only doing once a month and I haven't been seeing her. How has that changed with you know, how you're handling your emotions, or, you know, the depression that was kind of creeping in, their ability to have some perspective?
It's helping to release the pressure valve. So the stakes aren't getting so high. Depression doesn't feel like it's lurking, even though many moments can still feel hard and uncomfortable. And I'm able to access, oh yeah, they're supposed to be, because things are changing right now and this is the season. I'm able to remember, oh, it's temporary, it's okay. It's also helping me understand responsibility in a new way, what it really means to be responsible, as opposed to letting myself think that I can manage it, and then it builds up, and then it's impacting I mean, it's already impacting everything, but it impacts everything so much more. You, my work, my patients, my relationship with our son, and the list goes on and on. So I think, it's actually pretty cool. It's pretty freeing to think about what is within my control, and watching myself take the steps and actually seeing how easy they are. I don't feel overly burdened. I don't feel burdened at all by what could seem like a lot of extra work. I actually feel a lot lighter because the steps I'm taking are preventing so much more hardness, so to speak. So I like it. I like who I'm being. I like the actions I'm taking, and I'm seeing the fruits of those small choices, you know, moment after moment, day by day. I'll also say that if you are going to counseling once a week, or you are going to a meeting of some kind once a week, that's a win. That's a huge win. It's something to celebrate. And if you still feel unsteady, unsettled, like something doesn't feel quite right, or something's missing, you already know how to ask for help. You already know how to show up. You already know somewhat what the work is. So just keep doing more of it.
Yeah, I like that, because, you know, keep doing it. Keep seeing the counselor. Keep seeing the therapist. Keep going to the meetings. But I'm just a fan of in addition to, not in place of. So the other thing I want to talk about is, so tell me, I know you took a few notes. We just listened to that podcast with Melody Beattie about codependence, and I'll tell you some of my journey with codependence, and was kind of around me going, oh well, it's the families of that are codependent, I'm not codependent, or it's, you know, Sarah, she's the perfectionist, I'm not the perfectionist. And I read that I really just had to take a look at how much my emotional state was contingent on what I thought Sarah was feeling. What I mean by that, and I've shared a couple times, is when I see my wife's face and it doesn't look super cheery and happy, and I instantly think, I must have did something, she must be mad at me, or maybe I need to start a fight so at least I have some clarity and some understanding as to what the angst is, as opposed to, you know, being able to like be okay when everybody in the room is not, you know, super happy. So anyway, that being said, I read Codependent No More was Melody's first big book, but I read The New Codependency, which is the updated version. So if you're looking for a good book on codependency, detachment, working with people that are, you know, maybe struggling with mental health addictions, etc., The New Codependency was good. But what are some of the things that she said about codependency and detachment, the notes that you took? Because I know there was some cool things she said, and I can't remember what they are.
Yeah, I've got my notes right here. So a few things that stood out to me. If I don't, she said, this is quote, if I don't feel enough anxiety, I'll scroll just to feel more of it. Yeah. Right?
Yeah. That, in HCA, we talk about the addiction to chaos, right? That I often joke that when I, you know, work with someone through the steps and in a 12-step fellowship or whatever, the new guys, they start to feel this weird sensation, you know, where everything's calm and it's called peace and serenity. And because it's so unfamiliar, they'll go do something to create chaos in their life because they're so used to it, like get into a relationship or, you know, do something that recreates the chaos and uncertainty. But that, I definitely identify with that. You're talking about scrolling on her cell phone.
It's interesting because the definition of vulnerability is risk, uncertainty, and emotional exposure. Most of us don't want to feel at risk, uncertain, or emotionally exposed. I certainly don't. Although I'm learning more about it and I'm discovering it's okay, it's still freaking hard. And when we decide we don't want to feel vulnerable, we don't want to feel at risk, uncertain, and emotionally exposed, we armor up, right? And the three most common forms of armor are perfectionism, numbing, and foreboding joy, which means, oh, this is way too good, something's about to happen, the other shoe's going to drop. And so when I think about scrolling on my phone, I think about numbing. I think about zoning out. And it's interesting to me that actually, in her words, if I don't feel enough anxiety, I'll scroll just to feel more of it. One could say that's a form of numbing, turning it down. It's also turning it up. Yeah. Let me just turn up the dial. And that's not the typical phrasing or lens through which I would see it.
Yeah, I think that's one of the... You know, I've had a number of friends I've even struggled with it, is on social, is the tendency to compare everyone else's highlight reel with your life and how you feel. I experienced it a couple times this weekend of like, when I hear someone that's my age that I judge is more successful than me, boy, do I not feel good enough. Like, it's cool if you're in your 50s or 60s and you're balling. It's even cool if you're like in your, you know, early 30s and balling because you got lucky. But when you're in my words, but when you're like right around my age, I go, dude, I haven't done enough. It's so annoying. And then the other part of that is if we induce the chaos and anxiety, if we don't have enough, is the political perspective scaring the crap out of us, stories of something happening to kids, you know, people that disagree with us. And as much numbing as goes on, it's also a lot of anxiety in inducing, and this like anger, you know, sometimes certainty, if you feel uncertain or you're not wanting to feel vulnerable, anger is a really good way to get certain, because if you're wrong and I'm righteously right, it gets rid of that for you. What was something else that came up?
Second thing, codependency is when we consistently and without fail love the other person more than we love ourselves. Ooh, boy. In the episode, she talked a lot about coming home to ourselves. What does it mean to make a home in ourselves? Taking that time that we just talked about. Everything, and she says, you know, typically when we talk about codependency, we think about control, right? It's trying to control you so I can distract myself from me. And she said it's bigger than that. It's loving the other person more than we will love ourselves. And then she even went on to ask the question, which one of us really understands love? And I love that. As somebody who loves words and with clients, I'll ask, what's your definition of success? Most people don't even know. They want to be successful, but they've got no idea what it is and where they're headed. Even people with the biggest titles. Right? What is your definition of confidence? What does that mean? Okay, let's talk about it. And I've never applied that to love. It seems so obvious. It's so universal. But what is love? I think I'm trying to understand what that is every day. I'm trying to understand how to love you and love myself well. And I fall short a lot. And I also knock it out of the park sometimes. Yeah. But to even step back and really ask that question, I think is lovely and very important.
I think of, in that guessing at what is normal. In other words, when a person's perspective, this is an interesting thing when I'm having these conversations or when I'm talking to a group of people, even people that I feel are pretty, well-rounded as far as personal development or spiritual, development does the person even realize that the way that they love, the way they see the world, the way that they view...
Oh, shit.
Uh-oh. Might have...
Hang on, everyone. We're breaking suddenly.
Yeah, had some slowdowns going on. The emotions that they're having or what's going on in their life, do they even realize it's abnormal or dysfunctional? It's like trying to tell someone that they have a problem or they're codependent or they're not good at drawing boundaries or whatever the word. And they're like, what are you talking about? That's not what I'm doing at all. But they have no outside perspective because that's what they've always done. That's what their parents done, their grandparents, everybody they hang around with sees the world that way. They were talking, we were laughing a lot about, well, I'm not really codependent. I'm just helping. Even when they don't want the help, when they put the sign that says no help wanted, that's when we know we've gone too far. But it's very difficult to talk about these things with people that don't even realize the way that they are doing things is dysfunctional. And what I think is, how often am I guessing at what love is, or I'm guessing at what compassion looks like, or I'm acting serene, I'm acting grateful, but I'm not really feeling it deep within my bones. I think a lot of the work that I've been doing over the last couple of years is about getting more in my body, working through those long ingrained childhood beliefs, childhood traumas, sometimes we talk about, is going in and feeling like, what do those feelings actually feel like, so I can see what they feel like to me as opposed to guessing at it. Anything else stand out for you in some of that notes?
Yeah, I'll list a few things. We don't have to talk about all of them. I'll hang on to people, places, and things long after they're useful.
That's
good. It's good, isn't it? I think about just what plays in my head. Yeah. And it happened 14 years ago,
I think of kind of those dysfunctional, abusive relationships or those friends in your life that have, that they're not... they'll cancel on you, or they'll not bring their wallet and make you pay, or they've stolen from you, or they've lied to, these dysfunctional relationships that you'll either stay in intimate relationships much longer than you need, or you continue to be around people just because you grew up with them, knowing that they may not have your best interests at heart. That's what I think of.
Next one is detachment occurs incrementally, right? So we don't see our growth every single day. We don't see a plant growing, is the analogy that Melody was using. And we'll walk into the room and see that it has grown.
Yeah.
And that's true for us. And she said, it takes her 2 years.
Yeah.
In the process of growth to see that she has grown.
Yeah,
and that has held true over and over again.
Yeah, I think that she was talking about whether she sees it or other people see it. It's like sometimes in this, slog of personal development, this slog of, mental, emotional, and spiritual wellness, this trying to figure out God's will, fill the hole in the soul, it seems pointless sometimes, because you're like, I'm doing all this work, and not only do I not feel better, I actually feel worse. This isn't working. Is it even worth it? And you know, when she's talking about, you don't see a plant grow. Same thing with my son. Like, I can't, if I'm looking at him, I'm not actually seeing him grow. But if I'm away, or even think of a plant, right, you look at it, stare, you don't actually see it grow. But if I don't see it for a week and I come back and I go, wow, it's grown. It's the same thing with us. We can't see ourselves grow. Our friends and family can't see ourselves grow. But it's incremental growth over a long period of time. That's why I like doing these things consistently over a long period of time. And most of the time, other people see it before you see it. What was the other thing I was thinking about with that incremental growth? What was the line you just read?
Detachment occurs incrementally.
Yeah, I don't, maybe it'll come to me in a minute. Go ahead, what's the other one?
I'll say this quickly. We often talk about things as good or bad, which I don't believe in. Things are just things, and we label them good and bad. And so she talked about good and bad versus human.
Yeah.
So much of what we experience is simply human, and we decide to put a label on it so we can make sense of it, and we don't need to.
Yeah.
That's my slight addition. And then this, I think, was a really good one. Acceptance is forgiving others for who they are, and most importantly, forgiving myself for who I am.
Yeah, that's good. I think the thing that reminds me of, Jen Hatmaker was on this same podcast a while back. I don't know if it was Jen or someone. I think maybe it was someone else, but she was this parenting expert, or they were, you know, talking, and she goes, 70, knowing everything that I know, I'm getting it wrong 70% of the time. And
oh,
I,
it was Dr. Becky, the parenting expert.
Parenting expert, there you go.
Yeah.
Which the ones with Jen Hatmaker is actually really good as well. But this idea that I should be perfect, that I shouldn't struggle, that I shouldn't be sad or grieve, that I shouldn't get angry, that I should be happy all the time, that I should always be grateful, that I should always say the right thing. And I think that it is just not realistic that we are humans having a human experience. And a lot of times it's messy. And I can't help but to think it has to do with some of this perspective of we're born flawed. We are born sinners. We are born wrong, right? And we have to live our whole life trying to be whole and righteous and prosper and all these things. And it's just such a false expectation to think that we should be doing it all the time. The other lie that I find myself telling is, I think it's easy for you and hard for me. Like, your problems are, you know, not as big. You have little problems, I got big problems. Or you just must be really disciplined. You were born disciplined. Discipline's easy for you, it's hard for me. Or, you know, whatever the things are, is I'm always judging myself against this kind of made up illusion that it's easy for everyone else and hard for me. I think that was something else that Melody said, is everything, almost everything that we go through and experience in life is an illusion. Which is, you know, is it really hard, or is it the illusion of being hard? Is it, am I not disciplined, or is there this illusion that I'm addicted to the chaos and addicted to failure, so I recreate that over and over so I actually don't have to be accountable? And I can't figure it out on my own. That's why I need people around me and, you know, books that I read and groups that I go to and things that I listen to help remind me on a consistent basis to just take a little bit of the pressure off. And it's slow over a period of time. It's not quick fixes like what I want a lot of the times, is just give it to me straight and let's make it happen. Oh, that was the other thing they said was, why do I have to keep doing it like over and over? Like, why do I have to forgive every day, or why do I have to recommit every day? And it reminded me of the what's that guy named Rory Vaden wrote Take the Stairs. He said success can't be bought, only rented, and rent is due every day. And boy, is that applicable to recovery, spiritual wellness, mental and emotional wellness. My dis-ease of my thinking and feeling is that my recovery, right, my recovery can't be bought, my serenity can't be bought, my gratitude can't be bought, my healthy relationship can't be bought. It's only rented, and rent is due every day. Anything else come to mind you want to share before we hop off of here?
Yeah. Going back to what I was struggling with before I upped my commitment to my program, I found myself saying the same thing. What, like, why do I have to keep working at this? I just worked out this morning. I did a breathwork session and I took 10 minutes to journal. And now I've got to do more shit this afternoon. Are you freaking kidding me? I'm doing enough. You know, why can't I rest on this morning's laurels? Why can't I rest on what I did yesterday? And even my breathwork coach was reminding me that when emotionally I feel in the lower ranks of emotions, insecure, guilty, fearful, rageful, that I have a responsibility to move myself up to a place of ideally contentment and maybe even joy or positive expectation or freedom, but certainly contentment being this beautiful spot where nothing has to change for me to feel okay. What I have is enough. And that's that victim thinking. That's why I think I said earlier, I've been loving this feeling of being responsible, because that's within my control. And I can so relate to, screw this, more, again, now, me? No, come on. It's just such a funny dynamic. You know, you said a slog. This slog, and I was thinking, oh, I don't really like that word. Let's call it a commitment. It's a lifelong commitment, which nobody ever told me it was going to be that. I'm still wrapping my head around the fact that that's what it is, and boy, are you spot on, because some days it just feels like a fucking slog. And here, this is, I'll maybe end with this. Melody also said, when I'm contemplating surrender, not surrender itself, when I'm contemplating surrender, the fact that I need to let go, I know that it's one of the few things in my life that hurts the most. In other words, knowing that I need to let go, but I haven't got to the point where I'm actually willing to let go. That space, she says, I know it's one of the few things that hurts the most every single time.
Where can they find you?
Oh, Instagram at more.soul.sessions.
Is it with the dots?
It's with the dots in between, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Check out her website, moresoulsessions.com, and also her mini retreats, her pump up session, or Full of Herself membership, and her becoming her coming, but the book that's coming. How about that?
Pre-ordering?
Pre-ordering.
This is a whole
Well, we cussed already on here a couple times. This is definitely an adult podcast. Pre-ordering a book that's coming out called Full of Herself. And you know where to find me, K. Preston Moore.